WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives. One moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Henry Louis Gates has written a new memoir that addresses many racial issues from a very personal perspective. His book, Colored People, is a memoir about growing up in Piedmont, West Virginia in the 1950s and 60s. Gates writes that he wants to evoke a colored world of the 50s, a Negro world of the early 60s, and the advent of a black world later in the 60s. Gates is chair of Harvard's Afro-American Studies Department. He's written extensively about African and African-American literature and about race in America. His essays have appeared in The New Yorker, The New York Times, and its book review section. When Gates was born in 1950, Piedmont was a segregated mill town with a population of about 2,500 people, 350 of whom were African American. Like just about all the black men in town, Gates' father worked at the paper mill. He worked a second job at night.
He would work from 6:30 in the morning until 3:30 p.m. on the day shift. Come home, he would bathe. School let out at 3:30. And then he would go to his second job as a janitor at the telephone company at 4:30, and he worked there until 7:30. And this second job gave us an edge, you know, the margin of difference from most of the other black people in town. And my mother was a wizard at financial management. She always seemed to have enough money for everything, and she was very careful to dress my brother and me in ways that she would have found elegant. She was a very beautiful, elegant person with a great sense of style. And the reason that she did that was so that no white racist could look at us and say that we were dirty or unkempt. She was obsessed by how we looked in public around white people, because white people said that we were dirty, white people said that we smelled bad, white people said that we didn't know how to dress, that we didn't have a sense of subtle taste, et cetera, et cetera. So much of our early lessons from my mother after reading and writing were in grooming and in public appearance and in public presence.
When you went to elementary school, you went to a newly integrated school. This is the mid-1950s. What mm-hmm. was your family's attitude toward you going to a school that had just... Were they pleased about that, or were they afraid for you, or were they thinking that you were entering a world that they would never be a part of in the way you'd be a part of it?
They were very excited about it, but they were wary. They were nervous about it. They wanted to protect us. My mother would ask me every day when I got home, who had said what to whom? What did the teachers say? How were they treating you? Any sort of ironic remark I would make, she would grill me about it. I mean, what did the teacher mean? Mm-hmm. What was the expression on her face? What was the timbre and tone of her voice? And it was only, and I thought my mother just was obsessed with detail. It was only later that I realized that she was trying to be a fly on the wall, a set of eyes in the classroom to make sure that her two boys were being properly treated, because she had no idea. My mother had lots of experiences with white people, but in a servant's position. I mean, as a girl, she had cleaned the house of, as I write in the book, of the Thomas family. And she had been horribly treated by the woman who owned the house. And she was wary of white people. More than wary, she despised white people. And so she was excited about the possibilities that integration opened. She wanted both of her boys to be doctors. My brother is a very successful oral surgeon in New York City. And she wanted me to be a doctor, and I wanted to be a doctor too. And she thought that this would be a great route through this integrated school system, and that we would end up very successful people. But she also knew that there were great dangers, and we were warned not to dance with white kids, not to ask them to go out, not to socialize with white kids. We would get in serious trouble if we attempted to do that.
You write a little bit in your memoir, Colored People, about what it was like when Central High School in Little Rock was integrated. And I'd like you to read that passage for us.
Okay, let me see if I can find that here. Yeah, I remember this because we watched it on TV every night. It was like watching the Knicks and the Bulls or something. It was... we were glued to this television set. And that, of course, too, I think many of us forget that the preeminence of the news in our lives is coterminous in this country with the civil rights era, that news became increasingly important because they had an event that they could film every day. And that event, of course, was the civil rights struggle. In 1957, when I was in second grade, black children integrated Central High School in Little Rock, Arkansas. We watched it on TV. All of us watched it. I don't mean Mama and Daddy and Rocky. I mean all the colored people in America watched it together with one set of eyes. We'd watch it in the morning on the Today Show on NBC before we'd go to school. We'd watch it in the evening on the news with Edward R. Murrow on CBS. We'd watch the special bulletins at night interrupting our TV shows. The children were all well-scrubbed and greased down, as we'd say, hair short and closely cropped, parted and oiled, the boys, done in a permanent and straightened with turned-up bangs and curls, the girls, starched shirts, white, and creased pants, shoes shining like a buck private spit shine. Those Negroes were clean. The fact was, those children trying to get the right to enter that school in Little Rock looked like black versions of models out of Jack and Jill magazine, to which my mama had subscribed so that I could see what children outside the valley were up to. They handpicked those children, Daddy would say. No dummies, no nappy heads, heads not too kinky, lips not too thick, no disses and no dats. At 7, I was dismayed by Daddy's cynicism. It bothered me somehow that those children would have been chosen rather than just having shown up or volunteered or been nearby in the neighborhood. Daddy was jaundiced about the civil rights movement and especially about the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. He'd say all of his names to drag out his scorn. By the mid-60s, we'd argue about Dr. King from sunup to sundown. Sometimes he'd just mention King to get a rise from me, to make a sagging evening more interesting, to see if I had learned anything real yet, to see how long I could think up counter-arguments before getting so mad that my face would turn purple. I think he just liked the color purple on my face, liked producing it there. But he was not of two minds about those children in Little Rock.
Did you share any of your father's cynicism about Martin Luther King or the civil rights movement?
Oh, I thought Martin Luther King was the greatest person I'd ever seen. I'd never seen him, a public figure speak who could give you goose flesh. Lord knows that Reverend Monroe in the Walden Methodist Church wasn't passing out too much goose flesh in his weekly sermons. And that was about the only opportunity that I had to see a black person speak in public, except for my mother, who would read the eulogies at all the colored people's funerals. And she, of course, was a great orator, but that's very different than seeing someone on TV giving a speech about the right of black children to integrate a school system or the right of black passengers to sit down on buses in Birmingham.
The fact that you were the first generation to go to an integrated school, did that create any kind of generational gap with your parents' generation?
Oh, absolutely. I think that the way that we see the world is completely different. The way that my brother and I see the world is completely different. My brother started school in the segregated school, mm-hmm. and he was born in 1945. And the differences in opportunities that we had, for example, is very, very different. He went to West Virginia University after going to junior college, Potomac State College, for 2 years, and then he went on to West Virginia University Dental School. If he had been 6 years later, like I was, he would have gone to Yale, too, or Harvard, or wherever. That those opportunities weren't open. Harvard and Yale had very strict quotas on blacks until 1968 and then 1969, and I happened to end up at Yale in 1969. So that I'm an affirmative action baby, to quote Steve Carter. Though my spin on that, I think, is a little bit different than my friend Steve Carter's.
What was it like starting to learn about the Black Consciousness Movement in a small rural community?
Oh, it was exciting. It was so exciting. But that was the dividing line. That was B.C. and A.D. and race relations in this town and within our own family. For instance, I remember growing an afro. First, when I saw an afro, I couldn't believe it. I mean, all this hair. And I'd been fascinated by natural hairstyles since I saw Odetta for the first time, I think in the late 50s. And then when I saw Cicely Tyson on East Side, West Side. Remember Cicely Tyson?
Yes. Yeah.
And she had a short natural, and I remember thinking it was so strange. And the black people would sit around the front TV and say, why don't that girl get her hair done? You know, what's wrong with Odetta? She needs to go to the beauty parlor. And I was fascinated by how bold Odetta was. I mean, to risk, I knew that if the people in my living room were saying this, people all over colored living rooms were saying this, and to say, I have my own aesthetic. And then I started reading Malcolm X, and I started reading Malcolm X because I read it, a profile with Kareem, well, then Lew Alcindor, but now Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, who was a hero of mine. And he said, every Negro should read the autobiography of Malcolm X, so I ordered it from Red Bull's newsstand, and I read it, and I gave it to my father, and we argued about it, and it was exciting, and Malcolm was saying, we have to get all this grease out of your hair and stop processing your hair. And my cousin Gary, and the Coleman side of the family, started calling me Malcolm in Stokely when I was about 15. And he did it with, he still calls me that, and he did it with scorn in 1965, and he does it with scorn 30 years later. It was a threat. They would say, look, the white people here treat us pretty good, so why don't we just not make too many waves, and everything will be okay. Because essentially these people were fairly well paid. Eventually, when racism relaxed, they were able to own their own homes. Many now own two homes, one over in the country, on the river.
So you were seen as maybe rocking the boat and making it hard for other black people in the community.
Right. There was a mixed set of responses. Pride, I think, on the one hand, but also fear and anxiety on the other. Mm-hmm. Now, I was not alone. I had my three closest friends by my junior year were three black guys, and we called ourselves the Fearsome Foursome, Roland Fisher and Jerry Price and Rodney Galloway. And we were hell, I tell you that. We had Roland Fisher had a 1959 Chrysler with those big tail fins, and it was a convertible car. We had to use black masking tape to keep the snow and the rain from coming in, and we'd tool around in that car driving back and forth to Kaiser, the county seat 5 miles away. But we would read books together, like Malcolm X or Man-Child in the Promised Land or Soul on Ice. 1968 was the beginning of that was our senior year, and Soul on Ice came out in 68. We ate those books up, and we would talk about them. And I joined the Record Club of America so we could get black music. I remember, of course, we bought Aretha Franklin and Marvin Gaye and the Supremes and the Four Tops. But I got into jazz through my Uncle Erky, who was this expert on jazz. And he would tell me things and, you know, how I should be listening to this and listening to that. And I would order these albums. And so I read this article in Ebony about John Coltrane. And I looked in the Record Club of America catalog under Coltrane, and there was an album called Expression. So I ordered it, and the album came, and the Fearsome Foursome was gathered in my bedroom where we would hang out and listen to the music on my stereo. And I put Expression on, and I never forget this. Jerry Price, whom we called Soul Mo, because he was so much into soul music and the blues, looked at me after we'd listened to this thing for about 60 seconds, and he said, "You got to send it back, brother. Thing is defective." Because we had no more idea of how we were supposed to listen to this thing. And I looked at Roland and I looked at Rodney and I said, "What do you guys think?" They said, "There's something wrong with it, man. The thing wasn't mixed right. You got to send it back. You can't dance to that." And so, but I had a feeling that something was happening here that was not exactly clear, as the song said, and that we were not yet able to listen to it. We weren't literate in what Coltrane was trying to do. Eventually, of course, became literate.
My guest is Henry Louis Gates. His new memoir is called Colored People. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Henry Louis Gates, chair of Harvard's Afro-American Studies Department and author of the new memoir, Colored People. When you were 12, your mother went through menopause and at that time became very deeply depressed. And that was a devastating experience for you. You describe it as the crossroads of your childhood. Mm. And about that time, you also joined the church, the Methodist Church. This was in the early 1960s. And I guess there was a connection between the two. And you were very deeply immersed in the church for a couple of years. I guess what I wanted to ask you is this. You said that after you were saved, you worried that one day you'd open your mouth and somebody else's voice would come out as the Spirit possessed you to do its bidding, and you didn't want to be controlled by a heavenly remote. I was wondering what you'd witnessed in church that gave you this kind of fear.
Well, people talked in tongues all the time. People would be possessed of the Spirit, and a sign that you were saved for many people, and indeed for many of the people in our church, the ultimate sign that you were saved was the capacity to talk in tongues, to speak in a language that only God understood. And it could happen at any time. It was like a bolt of lightning. I mean, you'd be sitting there listening to the sermon, and people would be sort of feeling the Spirit, and someone would break out in this unknown tongue. And I was not interested in that happening, quite frankly. I also was afraid that one night I would be awakened in the middle of the night and have a visitation from an angel or see strange writing on the wall like the scene from the Bible, and then I would be compelled to do something that God wanted me to do, which would probably cause great pain and sacrifice. And Miss Sarah, who was a wonderful person, I write about her, and I hope lovingly, I found her very amusing. She was, you could talk about the Father, you could talk about the Son, but Miss Sarah was on first-name basis with the Holy Ghost. The Holy Ghost, you see, the fire of Pentecost, the spirit of life and living and salvation itself, this was what the black people in my church were fascinated with. The resurrection, that was okay. Virgin birth, that was okay. The fishes and the loaves, water into wine. But this visitation of the Holy Spirit was what the passion of Christianity was all about for my people. And that was a passion that I never had privy to. I always marveled at it. I was interested in it. I remember when Vic Clay, who was a very good friend of my brother's, went to the Holiness Church across the street for a convocation, as they're called, which was sort of all the churches in this region would come together and they'd have great preaching and great singing. It was a real cultural event over a weekend. And he was just got up to walk out of the church, and he told us later he just felt the Spirit hit him as he reached to open the door. It turned him around, forced him back to the altar. He found himself on his knees confessing all of his sins. And I did not want to undergo that kind of experience. I always wanted to be in control. I never lost a sense of double consciousness, as Du Bois would put it, a sense of sort of being in the church, but also watching everybody be in the church. I didn't want to be taken over by another consciousness.
In some of your recent essays, you've been writing about the politics of identity and the extremes that's taken some people to. And I guess I'm really interested in hearing some of your impressions on the issue on whether there is a growing anti-Semitism in parts of the black community. This is something you've been writing about since a couple of years ago. In an op-ed piece that you wrote in the New York Times a couple of years ago, you wrote that you're seeing a new kind of anti-Semitism. And I wonder what you think is new about it. What's different?
Well, to answer your first question, the recent statistics suggest that blacks are twice as likely as their white counterparts, their WASP counterparts, to be anti-Semitic. And that's very bothersome if you're an African-American intellectual. Many African-American intellectuals have been concerned with this, particularly people like Patricia Williams and Bell Hooks and Cornel West. Lord knows Cornell's written and spoken about this extensively, and I think has just completed a book about it. But we're equally concerned about homophobia in the black community, misogyny in the black community, the scapegoating of other ethnic groups in the black community. And the reason we're concerned is not so much for these groups, not so much for the Jewish community or for the Korean community or for the gay community, but for ourselves, for our own people, that we, if we give in to this temptation to scapegoat, we lose sight of the real causes of poverty, the real causes of the affliction that has torn the black community into two distinct communities, the haves and the have-nots. And that's what's worrisome about it. And I think that what we're seeing when we see black students on campus stand and applaud the most outrageous claims from demagogues, I mean black middle-class intellectuals, is the growing frustration that many of us have with the continued and indeed increasing poverty that's afflicting the black community. People feel so desperate. We have the guilt of the survivor, many of us in the intellectual class. We feel guilty about all those that we left behind. You see, a peculiar thing happened with the culmination of the Civil Rights Movement in 1964 or 65, the passage of the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act. White America opened its doors for some of us who were poised by hook or crook to rush through those previously locked gates and enter the larger white middle class. That situation obtained for a few years, and then, of course, there was a reaction. The doors slammed shut, and many black people were left behind. Entitlement programs were cut back. Affirmative action programs were challenged in the courts. Head Start was cut back under a series of Republican administrations. And it left behind quite a lot of people.
I have one last question for you. After having written your memoir about coming of age in the 1950s and 1960s in a small rural town in West Virginia, do you have a sense of what it was in your childhood that kind of prepared you most for being a public intellectual and for expressing opinions sometimes that don't fit in with the majority opinion, and, you know, for leading a life of the mind?
My mother and my father. There's no question about that. I tried to capture in this book my father's stories in my mother's voice. My mother was the model of writing. I repeat these scenes of instruction of listening to my father tell stories and watching my mother write and then watching her read her writing in public at these funerals and at the minutes when she was the first colored secretary of the Piedmont PTA. But they viewed my brother and me and our relationship, the relationship among the four of us, as a tight little world. My mother alienated herself from her family, from her nine brothers and her two sisters, and my father basically did the same thing by choosing to raise us as equals. We had to be reverent. I mean, Lord knows we had to be respectful, and we were punished if they thought that we weren't. But they treated us like adults in that they let us in on family secrets, in on, you know, who was doing what in town, in on their innermost doubts and fears. And they rewarded us when we... Well, not exactly when we were defiant, but when we were properly independent. And I mean by that, that if we took a stand, which they didn't agree with or they didn't even understand, they were willing to play it out if we insisted, as long as we wouldn't harm ourselves or get ourselves in trouble. Of course, we had to suffer the consequences if it was a mistake. But my wife and I have tried to use a similar method of raising children for our own two daughters, who are now 12 and 14. So that we were always in trouble with my aunts and uncles, particularly in the Coleman family. I mean, they always said, that boy's got too much mouth. And they were probably right. But the point is, I knew I could always run back to my mother and she would always defend me. And that was good. I had a lot of practice doing battle with my aunts and uncles. And I think that prepared me to do, if you can survive Piedmont with Coleman family, the black Muslims are a piece of cake.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much, Terry. It's great being back on your show.
Henry Louis Gates has written a new memoir called Colored People. He chairs Harvard's Afro-American Studies Department. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.